Yeah, hey, this is Luke Dick. You're listening to Walk on the Floor with me and Chris Shiflett.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is your old pal, Chris Shiflett, and you are listening to episode number 158 of America's favorite podcast, Walking the Floor. Can you believe that shit? There's 158 episodes for your listening pleasure. And this one is no exception. You can probably hear by my husky tones, I'm fucking tired, man. Tired. It's been a long week. It's been a great week. I got, there's things that I can't really talk about. Top secret rock and roll things that I can't talk about. But you will be excited about someday when you hear about them, I promise. You probably noticed since the last Walk on the Floor episode that I posted that there's been a bunch of new Foo Fighter tour dates that we're doing. Posted all that stuff's up there and I think for sale and stuff, so go check that out. And I am thinking about booking a few of those fun little acoustic side gigs, so hit me on my social media outlets and say, yay, come play here, yay, come play there. Let me know if that's a good idea, because I had so much fun doing that last tour, so I think I kind of want to do that again, so might work out a few of those just to have a little fun on those off nights. Okay, now, as many of you know, I talk about it on here, much to the chagrin of some of you listener people out there, but, you know, whatever, it's not the time to sit on your hands, and I ain't gonna shy away from it. I post things on my social media all the time about politics and my support of Bernie Sanders, and people just, it's just getting crazier and crazier. It's not just like the mainstream media, the Chris Matthews of the world, the MSNBCs, the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, you know who I'm talking about. It's not just all their hyperventilating about Bernie being the front runner, but God, when I post stuff on my Instagram and Twitter and all that stuff, the things people say, it's just, it's really bizarre. Honestly, I don't understand how people don't understand the difference between communism, socialism, and democratic socialism. Democratic socialism is like, it's just capitalism with some nice social programs involved. And yes, I realize they do cost money, but we have all the money in the world to pay for endless tax cuts for the wealthy. We have all the money in the world to pay for Wall Street bailouts. We have all the money in the world to pay for endless fucking war. But what, you're gonna cry about free fucking healthcare and free college and getting people out of college debt? Just fucking come on. Do a little Googling, people. Do a little research. It's not that scary. Nobody is talking about destroying capitalism and all that other goofball stuff that people just get so freaking hysterical about. That's not what it is. It's just, you know, more or less what a New Deal Democrat would have advocated in, like, you know, I don't know, 1960 or something. It's not scary. It's not radical. You want to talk about radical? Radical is all the shit that I just mentioned a minute ago. Radical is endless war. Radical is endless tax cuts for wealthy motherfuckers like myself that don't fucking need them. Trust me, when you hear rich people bitch and moan about paying more taxes, they're fucking lying to you. I know. Trust me, I live around these people. Anyhow, that's my rant. That's my weekly rant. Wasn't that fun? Just had to get that off my chest because motherfuckers been blowing up my fucking social media with their willfully ignorant nonsense. Just come on. Do yourself a favor. Go read your Chris Hedges, people. Spells it all out for you. It ain't that fucking hard. If a dumbass high school dropout guitar playing dipshit like myself can figure this stuff out, so can you. All right. Let's talk about something a little more fun, like my good friends over at Zounds.com, where you will get free shipping on every order with no exceptions and no exclusions, even crazy heavy items like tube amps, 8x10 speaker cabinets, giant synth boards, subs, drum kits, all the hardware and larger format mixing consoles ship free, baby, at Zounds.com. So get over there and get your gear today. Okay, let's get to the interview. We'll be right back. Man, I loved talking to Luke Dick. This is a great interview. It's a great conversation. We cover so much stuff. If you don't know who Luke is, he's a songwriter based out in Nashville who's had loads and loads of cuts over the years. I actually met him at a Dierks Bentley listening party a few years back, and we got swap numbers and stayed in touch ever since. But he's had tons of cuts over the years, like Burning Man by Dierks and Kill a Word by Eric Church and Bluebird by Miranda Lambert, as well as many, many, many others. He's a really interesting, thoughtful, creative, cool dude. And we get into the nuts and bolts of the songwriting, but also like the songwriting business and that whole Music Row thing in Nashville. He's also got a band called Steve, formerly known as Republican Hair, that just put out a new EP called Steve by Steve that you should go check out. But the real thrust of the conversation was sort of centered around this incredible documentary that he just made and that just came out called Red Dog, which I highly encourage you to go watch. I thought it was fascinating. His mom was a dancer at this strip club out in Oklahoma back in like the 70s and 80s when he was a kid, and he tells her story and all the surrounding characters. I just thought it was fascinating. It was really cool, really well done, and sort of not what you would expect it to be at all. So go check that out. And that's where we pick things up. This is Luke Dick on Walking the Floor. I'm a little bit lonely, so let's just jump right in on the movie.
Sure, dude.
I wanted to start there. Red Dog. I'm curious, you know, first off, I fucking loved it. It's awesome. So good. It's awesome. Great. It's a really good story. And like, you know, I don't know you as a guy making documentary films. I don't know if you've ever done anything like that before, but so I was like, I didn't know what to expect, and I didn't know your story. You know, I didn't know anything about your childhood or, you know, how you grew up or whatever. So I was like, what the fuck? And the first thing that popped into my head, with all due respect, is why did you want to tell that story? Like, these are the kind of stuff that most people would you prefer to kind of keep like hidden, you know?
Well, sure, man. Growing up in, I mean, I ended up growing up in pretty rural Oklahoma, and it's not something you want to be talking about on the playground for sure. But later on in life, once I became a parent, got into my 20s, got into my 30s, I was interested in stories, and I was really into This American Life, you know, NPR's This American Life, and I had a penchant for, I don't know, becoming interested in people's random stories along the way. And then I just decided to ask my mom a few questions, you know, and just about, I knew that she worked at the Red Dog, and we had friends that were just family friends, and I'd never looked at it as a subject to talk about or whatever, and it wasn't because I was embarrassed, it was right. Just that's just okay, friends, whatever. But then when I started imagining all the people that were in our life and the crazy people that were in our lives in terms of just the wild times or a giant bonfire or explosives coming out to the farm from these, you know, sort of old friends or whatever, I was like, wow, there's something here. And so I started talking to my mom, and as the stories came out, it was really interesting and heartwarming. And I also thought, wow, this is really could be an interesting subject to look at. And it's, I didn't look at it as cathartic necessarily at the time, but I was interested in it from just a human perspective of, this is a mom trying to raise a kid in a weird environment. What happened? How did it go? How did these other moms do it? What happened? What was the arc? And luckily, my mom's a superstar in terms of charisma on camera, so I got really lucky, and that's really kind of what drove me.
Was you like conducting the interviews throughout it, right?
That was my biggest part. I have a partner that I started making films with when I was living in New York. We were just doing videos for my music, or we would do these mini docs of random people in New York. And
so you've dabbled in this sort of thing.
Yeah. I got a camera, probably my first camera in 2009, 2010, something like that, and started messing around then. And always, not always, around about then, I started thinking about, well, this could be a really cool subject for a documentary if I wanted to make a movie about this.
Right.
Anyway, I got off the subject for just a second. You asked me a question.
Well, because the original question is, why did you want to tell this story?
Yeah.
Want to put this out there?
So anyway, I had gotten decent on a camera conducting the interview. So that was my partner is a really great technician. He's also a really great cinematographer, and both of us have an eye for composition. So we'd set a shot together, or he would set shots, and then I feel like my main contribution to the film is just talking to people, really, and just talking from asking the curious questions that you might ask sitting across from someone, you know, telling a story about an overdose or whatever.
Yeah, I'm wondering, like, how much of it, because, I don't remember exactly from story to story and person to person, because there's a lot of detail in there, but, like, how much of those stories that people are telling, and I'm thinking, like, specifically maybe some of the people that were closer to you, like, that, I think there was the guy, Russell, head, who had, like, turned in his mom and stepdad or something. There was that whole sort of drama with, and the mom was, like, a coworker, your mom's or whatever, but, like, how much of that stuff do you remember firsthand, or how much of it was like, were you sort of exploring your own, the events around your childhood through doing this?
It was a mixture of both, because you just...
Because you're a little kid, you don't know what your fucking parents are up to most of the time, right?
Exactly. I mean, and that's kind of the fun part of it, to me, was the exploration of what your parents were doing in their early 20s, you know, when they were rowdy. There were stories. I actually have memories from being 2 and 3 years old, but I don't remember, of course, the stories that my mom's telling. I'm not actually there when these things are happening. So there are stories.
I've learned in recent years to not trust my memories really at all. Because oftentimes my memory of something, like this just happened with me and my wife the other day, of something not that long ago. And we literally remember this thing happening exactly the opposite way.
Well, that's indicative of marital pathology. You know?
Yeah, we're getting off track.
That happens, man. Yeah. That's part of the fight, man, for the rest of your life. It was kind of fun with early memories, because once we started pulling other people into the stories, and once I found other characters, there was a corroboration that was happening across the stories that made you feel a little better that it wasn't just some harebrained re-estimation or whatever of an anecdote that happened. But with Russell, who's another child of a dancer, who's a little bit older than I am, but I remember running around with him as a kid, and he was in our life the whole time. He ends up turning in his parents.
And there's not a happy ending.
That's a particularly sad
ending. That's the saddest of the whole movie.
For sure, really. That's the most tragic situation. I didn't want to really make a gnarly, heavy, heavy movie, but I feel like you can't honestly make a movie like that and not show some casualties, you know? And I tried to gracefully do that, which the casualty being he and his mother's relationship after he turned them in when they had this big weed farm in Oklahoma after, consecutive fights that he would have with his parents, which was his mother was my mom's best friend. And so I remember all that going down. I remember them going to prison because that was by that. Most of the film takes place when I'm between the ages of baby or not conceived to the age of 4. That's kind of the timeline. But then once you start showing the arcs, it is into my teenage years or whatever. And so that kind of that particular story happened when I was 15, 16 years old was when he turned them in or something like that, you know.
Yeah. And there's so many great characters in the movie. And I'm wondering if you could, because, you know, obviously people listening to this will not have seen it and won't know these people. So if you could maybe, like, talk a little bit about, so, like, particularly, like, well, I forget the guy's name, but who was the guy that
Tiny.
Was the security?
Yes. Tiny.
You knew I was going to say
that.
Yeah,
you knew of course. That. So yeah. I'm I guess just a brief rundown. I mean, the film is centered around my mother, who was a scrappy woman who started working at a topless joint, a notorious topless joint in Oklahoma when she was 16. She had a fake ID and starts working there and making a lot of money. Then there's also this sort of strange counterpart, another dancer named Jeannie, who they ended up married to the same guy, not at the same time, but it becomes my stepdad. And then there's this weird kidnapping situation with my stepbrother, Tyson, all of a sudden in the middle of it. And I guess it's nice to preface it with everybody turned out pretty much okay and pretty all right. It's wild to look back on kidnapping stories with candor and laughter, strangely. But
it's that particular story resonated with me because, you know, when I was really young, my dad my parents got divorced, right? Uh-huh. And then they had like a custody battle and my dad lost custody and we were living in Maryland with him at the time and my mom was out here in California. And so when we were, you know, I was about 5 or 6 or something, and my dad goes, "Hey, we're going on a trip." And we're like, "Okay, cool." And we just get in the car. We just start driving.
Yeah.
And we drove down through like Kentucky and wound up in St. Louis at like his aunt's house. I have these vague memories of this like crazy road trip. And we're like in Kentucky staying with these people. And I just remember, whoa, they have an outhouse. It's crazy. You know, what the fuck? And at the time you just thought, oh, we're just on this some trip with my dad. But what we figured out after the fact was like, no, he was like, "I lost custody. Fuck you.
Yeah.
I'm fucking, these are my kids. And
yeah.
I'm not giving them up."
Yeah.
Know what I mean?
I mean, that was essentially the same deal with, my stepdad, and it was, and it's just so funny to hear somebody say, "You know, we just stayed on the lam for a year."
Yeah.
You know, we looked at Gila monsters. Yeah. You know,
that was before the internet, man.
Yeah, totally before
state
the internet.
State to state, probably wasn't a lot of communication between law enforcement. You know.
I have that same Ernest Tubb mug.
Oh no, shit.
Yeah, wow.
I always wish one of these days I'm going to do it. I gotta like. The thing that makes it New Jack is it's got the website right here. Like,
oh,
I got to scrub that off.
Yeah. Make it a relic.
Yeah, I know.
Tub,
exactly. I got to send it over to the Masterbuilt custom shop. Get that thing up to speed.
So those are a couple of the dancers. Then, of course, my former stepdad, Randy, who raised me in my formative years. My mom, is kind of the movie's kind of framed by her. Her relationships and the breakups and sort of on to another situation. And so she's been married for 25 years and to my current stepdad, who's a great guy, and they have a great relationship. So there's another dancer named Connie, another dancer named Janet, and then this wild character named Tiny, who was a bouncer in the bar. And a funny story about finding him, before I went to college, studied history and philosophy, and then got a master's in philosophy. I was teaching philosophy, and the whole time I was driving a forklift to make some extra money or pay my way through school or whatever. And I was being a musician, trying to figure out how to make money doing music. And there was this crew in Oklahoma who drove forklift with me, and you become blue collar buddies with all these dudes. And I did a Kickstarter to pay the animator for the movie because the anecdotes, these wild anecdotes, are animated. And this Kickstarter rep was like, "Man, you need to do a Kickstarter." I'm like, "Man, well, we can just raise the money. I'll just make the money. It's no big deal." He's like, "No, trust me, just do it." And I'm like, "Okay, fine, whatever. Will you guys help? Will you promote the Kickstarter, you know, through whatever?" Yes, we'll do it. So it became like a regional, kind of a viral sensation in Oklahoma. Mm. People were talking about it because the bar is so notorious. I mean, it's been there for 60 years.
And
it's still there. Yeah. We did 2 sold out screenings there at the Red Dog with the local active rock station there, who became a fan and were Kickstarter contributors.
Really?
Some of the DJs, yeah. So he said, do the Kickstarter. I said, okay. And I get a Facebook message from this guy I used to drive forklift with, and he's like, "Hey, my cousin said he knows your mom." And by then, I hadn't talked to these forklift dudes in forever.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, we had a slew of these emails come in. "Well, I used to work there. Well, I used to work there. Well, I used to work there."
Right.
And it became, you became inundated, and you couldn't tell what was bullshit and what wasn't bullshit, you know?
Or what's relevant to
that's
the story.
Right. That's right. And then I didn't think anything of my friend sending me, or my former coworker sending me the message. And then I get a picture from him a few days later of his uncle or his cousin, who is Tiny. And I sent and I just grabbed it and I sent it to my mom. I said, "Do you know this some dude named Tiny?" And my mom has just started texting in the past couple of years. It's hilarious. She's like doing emojis and shit now. And so I sent it to my mom, and she goes, is like immediately responded, "Oh fuck yeah, that's Tiny. He did my first tattoo." And I was like, oh my God. And so I get him on the phone. And
so you already have a cut of the movie at this point.
No, I have a lot of the movie filmed, and we're piecing it together okay. in terms of knowing how the flow is going to be and seeing how we're going to structure it. Then all these other characters start coming out of the woodworks, which I was like, okay, this is good, overwhelming. We're going to have to figure out how to incorporate this, but not make it a 4-hour movie that nobody wants to watch, you know? And so anyway, I get Tiny on the phone, and the first conversation is like, you know those people you get on the phone, man, where they kind of hear you and they kind of don't hear you all the time, you know? Right. And it was like, yeah. Hey, this is, and I'm like, this is Luke, who? I'm like, I'm making the movie about Red Dog, huh? You know, yeah. like this kind of a yeah. thing. And then he's like, oh, you know, living down here in Maud, out in the middle of nowhere, living down here in Maud, finally the statute of limitations ran out and I could come back. And I was like, all right, when can I come interview you, you know, this dude, you know? And so we, I call my partner Casey, and Casey's an introvert, you know, so this is how our relationship works. And yeah. I'm like, we got to go talk to this dude. We're going to go out in the middle of nowhere and talk to this dude. And by then, Casey and I met in New York, but he's living in Dallas now, and I'd fly down to Dallas, and we'd drive. It was a 3-hour drive, so it was a good little pre-game situation, talking about what we were going to do. And we drive through the country, and we get out to Tiny's land, and he's like on a backhoe, like putting in his own internet tower, you know, super resourceful dude.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause there's an element of like, I don't know if he exactly says it, but he's like living off the grid or something like he
man,
says
he's
something
a libertarian, you know,
well,
he's,
he said something, he had a great line in there and yeah. I can't remember exactly what it was, but something along the lines of like,
yeah.
If you're gonna
dominant
be an outlaw,
society. There's his Hendrix, you know, his Hendrix line about, you know, let me live my life the way I want to.
That's something like, I'm going to die of the way I choose.
Yeah. Me and Casey, we always had these conversations. I was like, well, we could go license if 6 were 9. Right. And I think
we're going to need another Kickstarter campaign.
Yeah, we need
that.
A Kickstarter campaign for get 100 grand together. And I think what we do is we get all these old dancers and we slow motion, you know, we put helmets on them and they get, and it's like this sort of go-kart race, you know, over Jimi Hendrix's If 6 Were 9, you know, this badass music, and we would fucking crack ourselves up about how we were going to put it together. Anyway, Tiny, when I got in there, he was super cool, but there was a litmus, you know. He's like, he wanted to make sure I would only, like, I wouldn't incriminate him, you know, and because there are all sorts of wild stories that we didn't include, you know.
Right.
And he's like, well, I'll tell you this, but you don't fucking, you know.
Right.
Whatever.
I'm trusting you.
Yeah,
I'm trusting
you. He made me smoke a J with him. And I felt like it was like I had to do it or he wasn't going to talk. Right. I had to be cool, you know.
Or, yeah. Yeah. Well, he's definitely not somebody you'd want to cross.
He's still intimidating.
Yeah,
at 70.
Yeah.
He's just a barrel of a dude.
You know, it's as I was watching the movie, I was just sort of writing things down. I wrote this down. I don't even remember what it pertains to or who said it, but it was just a quote that came out of somebody's mouth in the movie. Everything, all the time.
Yeah, that's Tiny.
That was Tiny too. Yeah. Right, yeah.
And then he said, literally, and I was like, literally, that's like Parmenides. That's philosophy shit like that right there. Literally everything all the time, but we have to go there. But I can't imagine, you know, I mean, I feel pretty, just generationally, my kids versus me versus my parents. It's like this sort of unbridled situation with my parents and that lifestyle and me. I, you know, it's like I would skip school and ride dirt bikes and like get rifles out and shoot rifles, you know, and it's like, at 11, 10, get the car out, you know? And I was like, God, I hope my kids don't do that shit, you know?
It's the weirdest thing about being a parent is like, you want your kids to have some grit and some real life know-how and to have some of the shit that you came up with.
Yeah.
But then, but at the same time, you're like, you know, I think about like I bought my kids BB guns not too long ago, and I hid them from them so that they could never use them if I wasn't there. You know what I mean? It's like that would have never happened when we were kids.
No, we were shooting each other through screen doors and shit like that.
You know what I mean? It's just shit like that. Where you're
here's this story, a BB gun story. When I was a kid, this is the stupidest thing. One of the stupidest things I've ever done is that I just happened to find a 22 shell somewhere, which I mean, there wasn't a lot of firearms in our household, but there was a pistol and a couple of rifles, a shotgun and a deer rifle. And I don't know why, but I had a little cartridge and I used to like get all the gunpowder and make tiny little weird bombs, whatever you could make, stupid kid shit, you know, pyro stuff at 12, 13 years old. But I remember me and my buddy, I had my BB gun out and I was like, I'm going to put this cartridge down and around the corner from me in the house, you know, I'm outside. And so there's a corner here. And I was like, if I get around the corner and I can aim at that cartridge, I'll make the 22 cartridge shoot off from shooting a BB at the back of it.
Right.
Not thinking about the idiocy, you know, you're going to get shot. So I shoot at this thing for 10 minutes and I finally, bam, hit the thing.
And it worked?
Yeah, it worked. And the bullet grazed the side of my leg.
No
shit.
And
I just the blood ran out of my face. I'm like, that could have been in your face, man.
Right. You know? Stupid. Or even worse.
Or even worse.
Yeah, it's nuts.
Anyway, that was that's kind of subtly part of the film is that, you know, hopefully that's kind of the American dreams. Your life for your kids gets a little better, but they stay on track too, you know.
Well, how do you obviously, you know, for anybody listening that has kids, it's certainly true of me, probably I'm sure you like when you have kids, you like that threw me into like heavy like you know, introspection about my parents.
Totally.
And running through things from my childhood and how they did certain things and reacted in certain ways and how they lived and how they parented and all that shit. Like, how do you view your parents now sort of through the lens of your own life as a parent?
I mean, I don't think that they got any of this. I didn't feel any ire from them after the film was done, after they saw the first cut or whatever.
It definitely does not read as a hit piece on your parents by any stretch. And your mom's obviously the centerpiece, but your dad's in there a little bit too.
Sure. There's a little regret with my biological dad who was just in there for a snippet and he actually came along later in life and I lived with him for a few years, but it just doesn't happen to be where the film takes place. So he's out of the picture, which in retrospect, in those years that he was out of the picture, I don't remember him in those years. So, but then there's my stepdad who was in the picture and there's all and these other characters. And so
That was part of it that really rang through in the movie, like as you as a little kid looking for a dad.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. I mean, that's a vivid feeling that is still palpable to me, and it's not like, you know, I'm sitting around crying on a therapist couch about that, but you know it's there, you know, and seeking out professors or whoever else, you know, who become little guidance stones for you along the way. You know, it's different. Men looking for dudes.
It's interesting. Like, I mean, I think it's kind of inescapable too. Like, even like with your parents, with the stuff you swear you're never gonna do. When you have kids, you do that shit too.
For sure,
it's fucking in there.
Yeah,
you know?
For sure. You're trying to check. You know, I'm trying to check myself, but all looking at the different. I wouldn't. It's hard sitting in life if you're not completely on the skids. It's hard to look at your life and say, "Man, I wish it were different."
Right.
Because you go, "Well, I kind of like my life, so I don't want to mess with the past, and it's impossible to mess with the past anyway." So it's like I look back on my youth as pretty fondly. I had a really fun youth. It was weird and with this mix of country and free thinking kind of people around me and. But with my kids, you know, I worry a little bit about sheltering them too much. You know, that's really what I worry about. Yeah. And am I creating a situation of blinded privilege or something like that, you know, because there's not the kind of financial constraints on them as there were on me. I'm sending my oldest to college and paying the way, you know. Right. And so that, and you know, there were scholarships involved and stuff like that, but it's still, you know, a big chunk that I'm like, I don't want a big bill at the end. I don't want some kind of a student loan, you know, to get saddled
with.
Well,
it's the joy of being able to provide things for your kids that you didn't have when you were a kid. But there is a downside to that.
That's,
you know, like there is the sort of, it's that thing of like raising dogs that don't hunt or whatever.
That's,
you know,
right.
What I mean? It's like, and that's the fear.
That is the fear. I was on a plane to come out here yesterday, and my oldest was on the way to New York to go back to college. Had a flight an hour or two earlier, and it was a really great break. But I've been thinking a lot, you know, how can you instill that kind of, you know, the kind of work ethic that's just required? I mean, there's nobody gonna help. My parents are there if I need tires.
Right.
If I really, you know, and it's right. Like when I had my oldest, I was 20 years old, so it was tricky times. It's not like you're making a lot of money at 20, and I put a few things on pause, and my mom was like, well, you know, we can help. And so, you know, I buy this $1,500 trailer, you know, so I can work and go to school and you know, put it together. And it's like, a parent that can, that's a big thing, you know, to be able to make sure that you're in a living quarters. And then, you know, and I painted it and I put new paneling on it, bought a new air conditioner, that kind of shit, you know. And but I don't know that my kids will ever know that kind of, I mean, and that's not even that kind of, if you just go across the world, you see bigger kinds of scrapping than that.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, there's a big perspective
on,
and even scrapping like that, life is pretty good. I could get a steak a couple times a month, you know. It is all right.
Right.
Know? I had a grill. I had a, you know.
Yeah.
It was. Life was good. You know. I had to fix my own brakes and all that kind of shit. But, and I don't anymore. I pay people to do that. Yeah. My kids have no idea how to change the oil, and I was like, well, I need to teach some people how.
And nobody does anymore.
Yeah.
Nobody knows how to fix. I don't know how to fix anything.
Yeah.
You know, my dad can fix anything. I can't fix anything.
It's too hard to fix modern cars. Number one, it's crazy. You need all kinds of tools and stuff. But can you change a tire? At least change a tire.
Right. You know? Just the bare minimum.
We've gotten away from hands and stuff, and it makes me want to, it gives me pause, like, especially with the new batch of kids that I'm bringing up. It's like, well, maybe I need a little wood shop. Maybe I need a little something to show that we don't just pay service people to do shit all the time. We can do this, this, and this, and this. So, you know, my son is 6 and he mows the lawn with me. So,
oh, no shit.
Yeah.
It's, nice.
I mean, he, as long as his attention span is on it, and then he bails.
Oh, man,
on
if
it.
I could go back and redo anything, my kids are 12, 13, and 16, you know, so they're pretty far along.
Are they mowing for you?
Their childhoods. What's that?
Are they mowing for you?
Fuck no, they're not mowing for me. They ain't doing shit for me. That's if I was going to say, man, if I could redo one thing as a parent, I would have strict chores for them all, which we never did, but you can't go back in time. I think they're good kids. I think they're good kids.
Of course, they're gonna hope if they listen to this, you're all really good.
You're all great kids, and I love you.
We all love you. We love you.
Well, let's back to the movie. Like, you know, how it seems like in the film, pretty much everybody seems at peace with their life and their past and everything. Is that, like, how do the former dancers feel now? And Tiny, you know, is that people getting their game face on because the camera's on? Or, like, are they really, like, because they all seem, they didn't seem like there was any, like, shame or anything attached
to
any of it?
Yeah, I don't think that there is shame. But I think that some people, I think everybody's happy with where they are. Do people have problems with where they are? Of course, there's this. I wish this were different. That's the human condition.
Right.
But in terms of real regrets about that lifestyle, I don't think anybody really has that. Now, the people you can't ask are the people who died from cirrhosis of the liver or who got murdered in the bar or whatever.
Right.
Who might say something different, you know?
Yeah.
I remember asking my grandfather, who was this really staunch blue collar dude, truck driver his whole life, and he died of COPD. He smoked a pipe his whole life. And he was on his way out, right? And I'm just like, okay, Papa, we call it. Papa, if you had to do it all over again, would you smoke? And he thought for a second, and he's like, yeah, I would smoke. I said, okay, so you're saying that the pleasure of smoking is more important to you than an extra 6 to 10 years. Well, I'm not saying that, you know.
Right.
But usually people are happy with where they are unless it's on the skids.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. I'm curious if any of the dancers' offspring or any of the people, I know the owner of the bar's son seems to run the bar now or whatever.
Yeah,
Did anybody else's kids sort of follow them into that life?
One of the dancers, it was a funny story that wasn't quite told succinctly enough, but one of the dancers' daughters worked in there too, and the dad walked in there one day, and the daughter was like, you can't come in here when I'm working, you know? Right. And he just happened to be a patron of the place. It wasn't as if he was looking, but it was such a, wow, what a twist. And, you know, I had a sister that worked there.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Not anymore, but it's, apparently generational occupation. There's so much money in it, and if you're lower economic class, it's a how else are you gonna make a couple $200-$400 maybe a night, you know?
Well, there was that one woman in there that talks about before she got the job there, she was working at the
Brahms
donut shop or for minimum wage, and then went and then got sober after her life as a dancer. And then went back to working at the same place for the same
page. Like, back to, I mean, minimum wage is pretty depressing.
Right. Yeah, when you're pulling in hundreds or thousands of dollars a week or whatever, cash under the table.
And nobody really saved money while they were there. That's the trick. They were just living a middle to upper middle class lifestyle, for a short period of time.
Well, how did you wind up, I mean, you mentioned this earlier, but how did you wind up going from there to teaching what was philosophy in New York?
Yeah. Well, my mom was a hard ass once we moved to the country. She was on me about grades all the time, and I felt like she was more strict than most of the other parents. And even though it was still pretty, by today's standards, a pretty laissez-faire situation, just kick kids outside and go play all day. But she was on me, and she was always encouraging me to do, and my stepdad too, encouraging me to do sports or band or whatever. And they were really encouraging to me with music and was school was first. And so, I felt like that's really having a parent be on you and encouraging too, that you're really smart and you could go to Harvard and you could do this and you could do that. I mean, I guess I could go to Harvard, but really looking, she didn't really know. I couldn't go to Harvard.
Right.
No way, dude.
Right, right. Well, you obviously did all right. I mean, you wound up teaching.
Yeah. Right. I'm glad I didn't go to Harvard. It would probably mean I had more pressure on myself to do academic stuff, and I like academic stuff, but, writing.
You're glad you didn't go to Harvard. You'd be running for president now.
No kidding.
You don't want that stress.
No kidding.
I'd rather be a songwriter.
I know.
How did you wind up going from teaching, and you were living in New York, right?
Yeah.
You're teaching. How did you wind up going from that? I mean, I know you already had a music life before that, but how did you wind up on Music Row?
I'd failed in Nashville. Financially failed in Nashville before I moved to New York. And I had a master's when I went to New York, and I'd given up on Nashville and said, I'm going to go to New York. My girlfriend at the time was moving up there, and it sounded fun, and I thought, I'll just go get a PhD. And then that way
I'll just go get a PhD.
Yeah, well, I mean, by then, it's just like one more degree.
Right.
Okay, I can do this.
Right. Had you moved to Nashville to try to break into the songwriting world?
Both. And as a solo artist, and my music life has been a life of opportunism more than focus, really. I mean, I've always loved creativity, but never known the infrastructure and understanding who it is you need to know or to do in order to make money at music. It's a difficult thing to navigate. And I see people understanding that at a much younger age now as a producer and songwriter. People coming in at 19, well, I need to do this because they know this and they do this and that and the other. And I'm like, geez, what are you on? You know, I'm just like me. It's just been sort of following interests and following lines and leads all over the world.
That is a really curious thing nowadays. I see
it's
that too.
You know, it's a different kind of ambition where I've always had a creative ambition, but never known the infrastructure ambition, you know, that is required too.
When people ask me like, what do I do to make it, or whether, you know, those kind of like open questions, I'm always like, fucking, I'm the wrong guy to ask. I have no idea. I just fucking dicked around. After a long many years of dicking around, I wound up in the Foo Fighters. I don't know.
Exactly.
It wasn't planned.
I was in New York, and I actually had a lot of friends who were in the ad business, and they're like, we love your music, you should make music for ads. And so I started doing that, and I was making money at it. And I flew out here to LA a couple of times and met this guy who was a songwriter who actually had a publishing company deal with BMG back in Nashville. And he's like, dude, you're a lyric writer. You need to be in Nashville, man. I'll sign you to a deal, and then you just go back there and start writing with people, and we'll set you up. And so they did. That deal kind of fizzled, but I had met this other guy. This is a boring story, but...
No, this is stuff people want to know.
All right. I met this other publisher who was an A&R at Capitol when I was hustling as an artist, and he's like, I've always loved your stuff. I work with... you know, Eric Church and Dierks Bentley, and I think your last record was really good, which was this real eccentric indie folk thing that I was doing at the time in New York, and he was like, this song and this song are great, and I think that you need to bring some of that into the writing room. And it was the first time where somebody wasn't telling me, man, you need to get more in the box, you need to get more like the market, or you need to do this or in order to win here, because you get in there and you start using the same language as everybody else, and that you're just a fucking wallflower in terms of a writer, and everybody wants to do it, so it's super hard to break into. And so I signed with another publishing company called Little Louder with my current partner Arturo Buenahora, and he I started getting a cut or two, and then Eric came along. His record was, they were writing for his record, and I had a couple ideas that Eric really liked, and so we wrote them together, and they ended up
because he came out of that songwriter side.
That's
of things
right.
Too, didn't
that's
he?
Right. He's a songwriter, so we wrote some songs. And they ended up being number ones, and then all of a sudden, a snowball starts building up. You know, and you know, somewhere in there, I moved from Manhattan back down to Nashville.
Okay.
And I was like, I need to give this a run.
And are you doing it like 5 days a week, writing sessions?
I can't, man. I hate writing that much. It's a constant struggle schedule-wise how to manage your time, because I get a little complacent and a little bit bored with writing the same perspective all the time. And so, I mean, I have this indie band called Steve.
Right.
And
formerly known as Republican Hair.
Formerly known as Republican Hair. And that... it became it's like a local sensation where we're starting to draw 600-700 people, you know, and it's filling up, and I'm like,
and it's not country,
it's
at
not
all,
country
right?
at
like,
all.
It's a very different thing.
I'm sort of yanking from like a little bit of Devo, a little bit of mixed media art, a little bit of hip hop sort of trap elements and stuff.
And why'd you change the name? Like, did too many Republicans in Nashville get upset about it? Or what?
Man,
what's the story there?
I'm going to give you the straight up answer. Is that it's really hard to make it as a band. Like, my idea of making it with Steve is I want a few markets to play, you know?
Right.
I want to feel like I am when we do in Nashville, where there's 1,000 people that's going to come out and watch you. And it's like, cool, if I could have a couple of dozen of these, then it matters when I put out a record, other than feeling so futile when you're making music or making songs. And so we were in a market we were playing Tulsa or Norman or somewhere, and the club owner, and it was a decent night, you know. It's like you're playing punk clubs, and the punk clubs are 200-300 capacity.
Yeah.
If they're full, it feels awesome, and you're having a great time. And it was almost full in the middle of the summer. It was a college town. Excuse me. And he said, man, we could have sold it out. He said, but I couldn't run any social media ads. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And he's like, well, the word Republican, it's like it hits their algorithm and it get bounced back and they won't run the ad for us. So they're trying to promote shows. Every promoter in every town is trying to promote shows, but the word Republican hair, the word Republican is a buzzword that just the algorithm kicks back and says it's a political ad. We can't do an ad buy for this or whatever. So you can't promote the show.
That is some modern fucking technology band problems if I've ever heard it.
It's some crazy Russian bot shit. And I was just like, as soon as he said that, my head goes, I'm not going to sit here and fucking fight for a band name when it's so hard to go in and scrap and get people to come to your shows.
You got enough problems already.
I got enough problems already. I'm just like, no way, man. Yeah. No way. And I was like, this has always, to me, been sort of bordered. This band's always bordered on everymanness and sort of clip art kind of mixed media stuff anyway, pop art, you know, and that's what I want.
Do you incorporate some of that stuff into the live show?
Yeah, man. I mean, the lyrics for sure. It's like I'm pulling on headlines and I'm pulling on I want it to sound like a collage of Twitter feeds kind of lyrically. And I had a song coming out called I Am Steve, which is a sort of existential trip out of just trying to figure it out, you know, but still this triumphant weirdness to it. And I was like, I told my manager, I'm like, fuck it. We're calling the band Steve. I don't change the website. I don't care. Whatever, man. We're not doing this anymore. I'm tired of. I don't want that to be our problem, you know?
So, right. Band names is a funny thing. I remember there was that band for a few years there called Diarrhea Planet, who everybody said it was a great band. I was like, I just can't listen to a band that has the word diarrhea in the title. Like that is an immediate turn off.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
There's it's nowhere like, around it.
That's a tough one, right?
Yeah.
Nobody really wants
to
think about
it. Because you hear the name, you're like, ugh.
Yeah, a planet of diarrhea.
That's like, I don't want to go to that planet, man.
And to tell you the truth, you know, when we started the band Republican Hair, it was before the 2016 election, so it was like, it's like a throwback. It's
not quite so loaded.
No, it's so loaded now. It became like this sort of WWE central. I'm just like, fuck it, man, I'm not doing this.
Well, what are some of the like big cuts that you've gotten over the years that people would know you by? For people listening that don't know your work,
I was most of them are country. You know, Eric Church's "Kill a Word." We were up for Song of the Year on there. I had one last year called "Burning Man" with Dirk Bentley, which was a number one.
Yeah,
and then
Brothers Osborne on that.
Brothers Osborne, yeah. And then
did the Burning Man Festival get irate about that at all?
They didn't call me. Maybe they call my people.
Right,
I don't know. But I don't know. It's not about the festival, really.
Yeah, of course not. Lyrically, it has nothing to do.
That's a whole other conversation about it's. But the heart of the festival is actually kind of true. It's like these dudes who are going out who are trying to, have a cathartic experience about something. That is somewhat of the song.
Right.
But as a cat, a Kacey Musgraves song, and she won Album of the Year last year. That was super cool.
Can you get into that? Because I've never had like a publishing deal in that way or been part of the sort of music row, like songwriting world. But I know a bunch of cats out there and have written a little bit, you know, here and there. Mm-hmm. Did some co-writes and stuff. But how does that work? Like, break it down, like the sort of financial side of that. You've written some big cuts, you know. So are you pulling a salary through your publishing deal, and then you got to recoup all that stuff when you like have financial? What does that mean to a songwriter when you get a cut and it's a hit?
Well, you know, it depends on how you do your deal with a publishing company. So essentially, for every song that you write, say you write it by yourself, 50 cents of every dollar is your writer's share. and then 50 cents is the publisher's share. And if you don't have a publisher, you're your publisher.
Right.
And so when you go to Nashville to get a deal, somebody wants to sign you to a publishing deal, they're going to bargain for some part of the publisher's share, which is essentially the controlling interest of your little piece of intellectual property.
Right.
So they, they say who can rent it and who can't rent it. Aren't there usually
you have to write X amount of songs per
year? Yeah, they'll tell usually, 12 to 24 whole compositions a year. Because if you write it with somebody, then it's all of a sudden 50-50.
Or isn't it oftentimes three people?
Yeah, right? Three people. Right. So 33. And so you have to turn in 12 a year, whole compositions. Right. Now, in terms of like advances and stuff like that, so they'll... Traditionally, a publishing company will offer you, you think it's a salary, but it's not a salary. They'll say $20,000 a year, $36,000 a year. That's an advance towards future royalties. And so then they'll split that over the course of a year and you'll get $3,000 a month or whatever. Once you actually start making money, though, that doesn't matter as much because it matters a little bit because it's an interest-free loan in a way, you know. But in my last publishing deal, I'm not going to divulge too much, but I just said the more money you ask for, if you don't have a hit, the more money you are trying to get for your advance, the more you're betting against yourself because they're going to take more of your copyright,
Right.
That's right. And so if you...
So a successful songwriter takes a smaller advance.
Yeah.
Right?
A successful songwriter can take a big advance and,
depends on how much they
everything in life, The Foo Fighters don't have to pay for their guitars anymore because they got everybody wanting them to
play. Don't tell people that.
Everybody wants you to play their Gibson guitars or whatever. So
in my case, it's Fender.
Let's make that clear.
It's Fender.
They have bean pushers, man, who figure out all that stuff.
But
that's the run of it.
For you, for somebody in your position who's had, who's gotten cuts, bad hits, successful songwriter, do you wind up going in and just writing with a couple guys that you have a good relationship with? Or do you sort of get chosen, like you mentioned Dirks, you mentioned Eric Church, do you get sort of chosen by the artist that likes your stuff and wants you to write for them, and then you go write with that person or for that person?
That's the ideal situation.
Right.
But I also really love writing with other writers because there's less of a... not all the time, but oftentimes there's less of an objective happening, and I feel like when there's not too much of an objective of my fans need this or I need that, which... I would say Eric is an interesting example because he likes to just be creative. And there's not the label isn't talked. His A&R isn't talking to his head, as he's writing a song.
Right.
And I'm more interested in that, and I feel like I stay more inspired if I can feel the freedom of writing. And I know it's a format, and you you can't say fuck, for instance, on country radio.
Right.
And there are other rules. That would be an interesting segment of the rules of country versus rock in terms of writing style.
Well, that was one of the things I kind of wanted to ask you about.
Yeah.
Are there any scenes of writers in other places that are comparable to Music Row? Like, do you come out to LA and write with people? Is there a writer's scene here?
There is a writer's scene here. I'm writing today, and a lot of people from LA will come write country music, but it is different to me because it's so...
Is this more pop-based?
It's melody-centric and sonic-centric, sonics can drive a whole song in a way,
Right. Well, I would argue that's sort of the through line of country music through the years.
It's
lyric driven.
For sure.
Right.
It has to make sense. The more interesting the concept, the better the song can be. Whereas I love Led Zeppelin. But it's like, I want a whole lot of love.
Right.
It's just awesome. It's not like, well, let's pause and ruminate on a whole lot of love. What I mean, right. How much
yeah.
love?
Yeah.
Know?
I mean, yeah.
Every inch of
like
my love?
A lot of my favorite rock and roll bands, well, I don't even know what the fuck they are singing. You know, that, it's not that, even really about that.
That's a big difference. And yeah. it's almost like uncodifiable in rock and roll to me. And it makes it a scarier place to ride in because there are less rules. And pop too, I feel like there's a few less rules to that you're working with. And so it's just all this sort of, this prime matter, you know, that you're messing with.
When you're writing like country stuff, because I've heard a lot of guys, writers say this, that they sort of start with the hook line
yeah.
and sort of work backwards. Is that sort of your process?
I do that a lot. And I was just, sometimes I'll text artists. I'm like, I'll have an idea late at night and I'll just like, here's this idea for a song. It's like this. And you just send them, you'll send them a stanza. Like here's the title. Here's the hook of the title. Here's the stanza that I'm thinking about. I have a melody, but we can mess with that.
Right.
You say that for me, you know, yeah, let's do that. You know, that, right. that kind of a thing.
Interesting.
So yeah, I mean, it's highly concept driven,
right.
Which is really exciting to me. And even though, I mean, every song doesn't have to be a representation of my artistic self or anything. I feel like it's this sort of character writing sometimes, you know,
sure.
and it's this overlap of sensibilities between me and the artist or me and another writer or whatever. And used to be, I was like, well, I need to be expressing myself or I need to be, this needs to be about me. And when I left Nashville, that's how I felt. When I came back after writing a few things, like especially, this sounds so fucking corporate, but after writing for ad, the advertising companies would send you, we need buzzwords like this. And I would be like, well, that's cheesy. I don't really care that much about that brand of ketchup, you know, whatever. But then I would be like, could I make something cool out of this that I cared about, you know?
Right.
And then trying to care about whatever it is that you're doing. And it changed everything for me. You know, it changed my instrumentations. It changed, you know, like my feeling of a need for this kind of a guitar tone or that kind of a guitar tone, so that you can start to like fall in love with different tones of music and different shades and different kinds of lyrics and stuff like that. And so that you're really trying to love it on every level. And when I'm writing or when I'm for country, even when I don't do much ad work anymore, but when I was doing spec work for ad, I was really trying to, could I make something cool? You
right.
know, I want to love it, you know?
There's some scenes in the movie of you recording some stuff,
yeah.
working on some stuff at your mm-hmm. computer. Is that kind of how you write? Do you sort of write in the box like that with other people or like, yeah, because I always wonder about that with writers. Like, how much of a change is there from what you write in the room to what the producer kind of does?
I mean, I produce too, so a lot of the stuff that I do in my own studio will end up on the record.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they'll call me for, hey, can you send me this guitar track or can you send me these drums you came up with or whatever? And then sometimes I'll end up with the whole production. Maybe I'll go re-record some drums in a studio. But sometimes we just sit down with a guitar. I don't have anything ready. I'm not inspired. People walk in. This is supposed to be a collaboration. What have you got? You know,
right.
what have I got here?
Right.
And yesterday was a really nice day that was easy. You have to, and that was easy in that I didn't have anything. And I said to this artist, I don't know you. I don't want to assume that you want to do this style or that style. So what's going on?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, 4 or 5 hours, we have a song, you know,
right.
and a little demo that we did.
Do you finish an idea every time, sort of regardless of if you're kind of ultimately happy with it?
I can't anymore. Used to be, I put pressure myself, but this last year and this year, after success kind of messes with you a little bit and you start feeling like, every time I've had success with a song, I felt like it was great when I was making it. You know what I mean? And so if
right.
I'm not getting that feeling of it's great, I start getting scared. And I'm like, I'm wasting time.
That's such an interesting part of it. Like, that happens to me so often. And I always feel like the solution is just to write through it.
Yeah.
But there you have those moments where you feel really inspired and you sit down and you start working on it. And you get like a verse and half a chorus written. And then you're like, I just lost the feeling.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? What now? How do I get that back? How do I get back to that excited place that I was a second ago?
I have lots of things that are sitting there waiting to be finished that I know that I will finish. Like if it's like a Steve thing or something mm-hmm. that I'm, I believe in, it's just a matter of me, plugging through the production, you know, and getting done. But then I have things that I start with other people. And then there's this other psychological dimension of feeling like you're letting somebody down. And I'm kind of a people pleaser in that regard, where it's like, and then you do start writing with your friends all the time because you choose your tribe, you know? And so they're coming, it's like, God, I'm letting them down, but I don't really, in my head, I'm thinking, gosh, I'm feeling like I'm letting them down, but I really don't like this. And I could just let them keep writing the lyrics and try to help them serve their muse, you know? It's like, whose muse are you serving in the day? On the best days, it's a collective muse that everybody understands, but sometimes it's this, you know, a fragmented situation where you're just like, I'm going to help you. But it's also hard because I feel like I get mercurial sometimes where I'm sitting there going like, God, what are we doing? You know, what are you doing? So I feel like songwriting and creativity in general is a practice, you know, and it dawned on me in the past year, you just have to get your mind ready for whatever's going to happen. And maybe it's plugging through that day and maybe it's not plugging through that day, but I don't want to commit to absolutes, you know, in terms of, and then maybe one day I won't think something's great, but everybody else will.
Right.
So you don't know that can't happen. I know writers that's happened to of huge songs. So I'm just like, you can't.
Yeah, one of the biggest hits that Foo Fighters ever had, Dave didn't even want to put on the album.
Which
like
song?
Nobody in the band felt strongly about it at all. It was at the Best of You.
No kidding.
Yeah. It was sort of like almost, it was kind of a throwaway. Like, oh, maybe that'll be a B-side. And our manager was like, nope, that's going on the record.
Can I
that's
tell you, I want to tell you a college Foo Fighters song.
Oh, hit me.
First of all, my very first rock show ever, we was all covers, and we were 17, and we played in this band called Fixture, which sounds like Failure, which sounds like Filter, but we were Fixture,
right?
And we
totally different, bro.
And we packed out this little punk club of like 400 people. Everybody in our high school came, and we. What did we destroy? We destroyed Everlong, man. We destroyed it. We started with Cherub Rock and destroyed some Everlong. But every morning in college, you know, graduated, me and the drummer went to the same college. And every morning they had this little place called Alvin's. You get a donut and a coffee and sit there. And they had a video machine. You could bring up a video. Mm-hmm. And every day we would bring up the Everlong video with the giant hand smacking people around, dude.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll tell you a funny story. One time, this was like after I'd been in Foo Fighters for years, mm-hmm. and I was in Brazil on tour with, I had a little band called Jackson United, a little side project thing, mm-hmm. and I went down and just did this fucking crazy tour in Brazil. It was so fucked up. It was like, anyway, that's a whole nother story. But during that tour, my band played a local band in some beach town we're in.
That sounds
awesome.
Was like,
hey, we cover My Hero. You know, would you play it with us? I was like, yeah, sure, cool.
Yeah.
And I got up there and we played it. And you know, like the way that we play that song live is like a little different than the record or whatever. It's not exactly the same. And I think they had learned it like to the album thing. Uh-huh. And we played it. And the dude, one of the dudes in the band, like, corrected me on how to play it.
Oh, he did.
Like, motherfucker. Wow. I'll tell you how to play it.
Wait. He wanted to take you back to band practice.
Right, huh? Yeah. I was like, come on, man. I'm doing it the real way. I'm in the band, motherfucker.
I had this weird dream around, for the movie, one of the dancers lives down in Costa Rica. And they were having a little reunion down there, and the scenes where all the women are together, that's in Costa Rica.
Oh, okay.
And on the Gulf side in this little town called Puerto Viejo. And it's like there are a lot of expatriates. There's no big commerce. It's all like one level shack, yoga retreats, but also just mixed with the locals, you know, it's super cool. And there's this club there. And I was like, God, I had two or three of my homies down there helping. And I was like, man, wouldn't it be awesome to just bring the band back and turn all your songs into reggae songs, you know? And just be the house band for the week and see if it worked. And just
A retirement plan right there. If I open the taco stand to surf every day, that's a fucking count me in. Yeah, when you're putting that band together, you let me know.
All right, dude. All right.
20 years from now, or 10. Uh-huh.
You sing high harmony?
There you go. So, okay, so what? Last thing, where can people see the movie and when and how and what's your plan for all that?
Sure. The movie is out now. It just came
out
last week. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So iTunes, Amazon, okay. Google Play, whatever.
Red Dog.
Yeah. Red Dog documentary. We were number 5 first week in documentaries.
No shit.
Yeah.
Well, it is a really good movie, dude. You should be fucking proud of yourself.
Thanks, man.
It's good stuff.
Thanks, man.
I don't know if you want to play a song. Some people do, some people don't.
Whoa.
And you could. And
I hadn't thought about
that. You don't have to.
I'll play a song.
I throw it out there and, you know, I'll grab you a guitar.
Yeah, give me
a
guitar.
How about that?
So the soundtrack of Red Dog, I'm finishing up and we're going to do a little label deal and put it out. And there's some really cool features on the record. Patrick Carney, the Black Keys, is producing some of the stuff with me, and then there's some country, other country features on it. The project has really gotten a lot of support in Nashville community, and then also it's starting to see support elsewhere, which is really cool. But this song, since the movie's out, I've been getting a bunch of emails and stuff about where can I get this song. It's the credit track. It's called Polyester. So anyway, that's what it is. A sea of red, all the dirt, the debt, and the cigarettes, and all the words that Jesus said, still in my heart, still in my head. Oh, daddy's on the couch in a bush light coma, brother's on parole stuck in Oklahoma. 20-1, I wouldn't get my diploma, but there it is hanging on the wall. And I can hear him back home singing, hail, hail, trailer park hero. Got a new car and a used tuxedo. Oh, hail, look at you now. You got your first comma in your bank account. Well, you made it out, but you're still in. We still remember when your mama was smoking in the third trimester. Yeah, you might wear leather, but you're made of polyester. Yeah, polyester. Chris, I've been sick, so can you deal with me? All right. Here we go. I got a nice house out in Tennessee. It ain't got wheels, but it's got AC. Mama's on the phone updating me. Guess sister won a raffle, got a new TV. Brother's off the beer, now he's on the Dr. Pepper. Brother hit a deer, got it grilling on the Weber. 1,000,000-1, I wouldn't hit a gold record, but there it is hanging on the wall. And I can hear him back home singing, hail, hail, trailer park hero. Got a new car and a used tuxedo. Oh, hail, look at you now. You got your first comma in your bank account. You made it out, but you're still in. We still remember when you dropped out of Votech first semester. And you might wear leather, but you made of polyester. Yeah, oh hell. Couple kids in the backyard swinging, light years away from my upbringing. The back of my head, I hear them back home singing. This ain't hell, hell, trailer park hero. Got a new car and a used tuxedo. Oh, hell, look at you now. You got your first comma in your bank account. You made it out, but you're still in. We still remember when you were sitting in your room trying to learn Def Leppard. Yeah, you might wear leather, but you're made of polyester. Well, not too shabby for a troubadour drifter. Yeah, you might
not wear leather, but you're made of polyester.
Yeah.
All right, dude.
I love it. That's a Walk on the Floor exclusive right there.
Yeah. It's not out there. You gotta have it there.
Yeah, come on. That was Luke Dick on Walking the Floor playing a Walking the Floor exclusive version of his song Polyester, which I fucking love. How great is that song? I'm telling you, the man is a great songwriter. I'm going to put up links to his website and his movie and everything else so you can check out where he's at and what he's doing. Luke Dick on Walking the Floor. That's it for this week, kiddos. We'll be back in a couple. This is Chris Shiflett over and out on Walking the Floor. Adios, amigos.